start with your thesis, start with your premise. Do you have a specific definition of toughness, or can toughness be many things?
And I think that's what it comes down to. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. When we're talking about toughness in the modern game, I think in the 80s and 90s, you know, we think of the Bob Proberts and the Marty McSorleys, the guys who were the huge enforcers who came in and threw lots of punches. But if you look at fighting rates in the NHL over the last 10 years, they've gone down considerably. We don't even average a fight per game anymore. We're averaging about a fight every 5 games, realistically. So fighting, I don't think, can be your definition for toughness anymore. I think when we're talking about toughness in the modern game, we're talking about your ability to intimidate someone on the forecheck, win board battles. I think when I'm thinking of toughness with the Maple Leafs, I think of someone like Zach Hyman. He goes into the corners hard, he wins puck battles, and he's willing to take a hit to make a play. I know that there are some players who kind of shy away from contact, will try to avoid it, stay on the perimeter. And then you have the tougher players who go into the corners, take the hits, go to the tough areas in front of the net, maybe like a Patrick Hornqvist on Pittsburgh. These aren't guys who necessarily scare the crap out of other teams with their giant size and giant physicality. But if you're willing to make a play and get hit while you're making that play, I feel like that's kind of the modern-day toughness, because fighting isn't as big a part of the game anymore. You know, we're seeing the instigator penalty has eliminated a lot of that. So I'm of the opinion that toughness, to me, means your ability to use your physicality to overpower the opposition, intimidate them a little bit, but more importantly, just drive results using your size, using your grit. And if you can have that puck in the offensive zone for as long as possible and you take a bit of pain to do that, for me, that's what toughness is. And I think that's why guys like Zach Hyman and Connor Brown were such popular players in Toronto, because they had that element in their game.
Ian, you tend to do, you work from a more analytical bent than some writers, and that's a fantastic way of doing things and provides a very different, sort of perspective. I'm just wondering where you think that toughness would show up from a statistical standpoint. I'm not going to ask you to delve too much into percentages or scary words like expected goals for or anything, but where do you think we can find toughness within the numbers?
And that's, again, the hard part. It's often seen as something that's intangible that you can't measure, but I'm never satisfied with that answer. I'm never satisfied with just throwing my hands up in the air and saying, oh, you can't measure it, so let's just watch film and assume that that's the only way we can do it. I think if you look at hits taken in the offensive zone, that's something that's very indicative of, okay, which players are against the boards, are willing to take a hit and make a play. If you look on the Leafs, the leader for the Leafs is Zach Hyman. And especially, I'm of the opinion that hits taken in the offensive zone are what matters the most, because that's indicative of the fact that you have possession, you're playing on offense, which is where you want to play. But if you're willing to take the hit in the offensive zone, that's a very good thing, as opposed to someone who shies away from the contact and might give up the puck. You can look at something like board battles or one-on-one puck battles that are won. That's not something that's available publicly, but if you look at some of the private tracking companies like SportLogic, I know Andrew Berkshire, who works for Sportsnet, he has access to some of that data. There's some cool stuff you can look at where players who win a lot of board battles, like Jake Muzzin, is one of the best in the league at winning one-on-one puck battles, and that shows itself when you watch the games. He's a strong player. He's a tough player. He's not a goon out there. He's not a bad hockey player, but he's able to use his size and his physicality in a way that helps drive the puck up the ice and help his team stay on offense. So I don't think we're looking for the kind of toughness that results in you winning a fight or checking someone through the glass anymore, because as cool as that is to watch as a fan, does that really help your team win the game and stay in the offensive zone with the puck and generate chances? I don't really think it does. So when I think of toughness, I think of the guys who are really doing it in a productive way. And I think of the Jake Muzzins. I think of Colton Parayko, if you watched him with St. Louis Blues. Those are the kind of guys who I think are using their physicality, using their toughness in a way that helps drive results in the modern game. And it's really tricky because everyone has a different definition of toughness. But for me, it's winning those battles, using your physicality to overpower the opposition and make sure that your team has the puck at the end of the day.
Now, Ian, everything becomes heightened in the playoffs. I mean, goaltending is a great example about regular season stalwarts who don't play so great in the playoffs. So if we look at the Leafs on this topic in the playoffs, three times in what, the last 7 years, they've lost 7-game series to the Boston Bruins. The first two, they came back from a deficit to force a seventh game. Last one, of course, they had the edge in game six and kind of blew it and lost in game number seven. Nazem Kadri draws two suspensions. Perception is he has to overcompensate for a team that's not tough. Bruins perceived being a tough team. I mean, What is the reality in your mind about Leaf team toughness versus Bruin team toughness in the playoffs? What's fact? What's overblown?
That's the hard part, because I think it's easy to narrativize and say that the Leafs lost because they weren't tough enough. And you look at Nazem Kadri, who took a dumb suspension in back-to-back playoff series, trying to be the tough guy. But then I look at a game like Game 5 this year with the Leafs in Boston, and I thought that was a very tight checking game. There wasn't much space available. Everybody was finishing their checks. Everyone was right on top of each other. And I thought the Leafs actually outplayed Boston in that game and came out on top with a late third-period lead. Those are the kind of games that you want to see the Leafs win in the playoffs, where the opposition's right on top of you at the forecheck. There's no space out there. You're getting hit right when you get the puck. There isn't any time to make a play. But the Leafs still came out on top in that game. So I'm of the opinion that that was a really close series. It really could have gone either way. I know that they had a chance to win in Game 6, they had a chance to win in Game 7, and it didn't quite happen. So I'm not here to say that the Leafs need a tough guy in order to win a playoff series against the Bruins. I thought they easily could have won last year, and the bounces just didn't go their way. But I think there is an element of, what if they had someone like a Radko Gudas? What if they had someone like, even a Tom Wilson? As much as I'm not a huge fan of the high hits that he throws, and I think that those should result in more suspensions than player safety tends to give him, I think that having that element could be helpful in a playoff series when someone like a Brad Marchand or someone like a Dustin Byfuglien, or pick any player who really is mucking up stuff after the whistle. I think it does help to have someone on your side who can do something similar and try to set a standard that the other team won't cross the line. And if they do, at least you have someone who's willing to cross the line. And it's funny, as we dive deep into this conversation, sometimes we end up going really far down a rabbit hole and talking about the chances of a player getting injured and then the chances of brawls breaking out. And I don't like getting that far down the rabbit hole, but I do think there's a way to look at the Leafs team and say, even though there's a ton of speed, there's a ton of skill, especially up front, I think there's a way to include someone in your top nine who also wins a bunch of puck battles, who also can intimidate the opposition on the forecheck. For fun, let's talk about a guy like Mason Marchman. He was on the Marlies last year. He is excellent at bothering the other team. I know Justin Boyne could probably tell you some stories about him. He's probably not going to be a top six NHL player, but you put that guy on your fourth line, I feel like he could make a difference in a playoff series. So I'm curious to see what happens with the Leafs, because I know that Dubas tends to be very pro-skill and wants all 12 of his forwards to have skill, all six of his defensemen to be able to make a breakout pass. But I think if on top of that you can add a little bit of sandpaper and some guys who can win some puck battles and bother the other team, I do think there's still room for it in the NHL these days, but you need to be able to play hockey. There's no more Colton Orr's or Fraser McLaren's in the game anymore.
With Ian Tulloch, who covers the Maple Leafs for The Athletic, Sportsnet Today, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
I thought that was interesting, looking at the Toronto Maple Leafs and maybe adding someone like Mason Marchment. I've gone on record here as saying I think the Leafs are a bit of a science experiment, the way that they're so one-dimensional. They really are skill-first. Do you think that there's a level of skill you can reach, and I guess more importantly, that the Leafs have reached, where the fact that they're openly, they don't seem to care about toughness all that much, that they can sort of still have success in playoff hockey without adding some more of those physical elements?
Yeah, I think if you look at teams like, let's say, the Tampa Bay Lightning over the last few years, I know that they haven't actually won the Stanley Cup, but they've been probably over the last 5 or 6 years one of the most consistently strong teams in the NHL. And they don't tend to rely on physicality and toughness too much. They just have way more skill than the opposition. And when you look at the way that they draft players, they tend to take chances on smaller skilled players. Nikita Kucherov slipping into the second round. Braden Point slipping into the third round. Andre Palat, I think, went undrafted, and then they got him as an overager. So I understand their philosophy, and I think that that is probably the best way to evaluate talent these days, is that you go for skill first, make sure that you have as much skill as humanly possible. And then if you can fill in some grit and some penalty killing and some intimidation, that's great to fill in along the periphery of your roster. But I think you need to prioritize skill first. So if we're looking at the threshold, how much skill do you need to have before the element of physicality doesn't matter? You're probably going to need a lot. Let's be realistic. I mean, we can look at Pittsburgh when they won their back-to-back Stanley Cups. They had the Crosby, Malkin, Kessel power play unit. I don't think they had too many fighters on those teams. So there is a way to do it. I mean, even if you look back to Chicago when they had their heyday with Duncan Keith and Patrick Sharp, Hossa, Kane, Taves, there weren't too many enforcers on those teams. They just relied on having an elite amount of skill. and making sure that they used it to get the puck up the ice and stay on offense. So I do think that there's a recipe for it to work in the modern day, but you need to make sure that you have a ton of skill, because if you're not winning a ton of puck battles and if the opposition's kind of overpowering you on the forecheck, you need to make sure that you can really burn them on the counterattack. You have lots of finishing talent to take advantage of your power play opportunities, and you need to draw lots of penalties. I know that's something the Leafs kind of struggled with this past year. They had the lowest amount of penalties taken and the lowest amount of penalties drawn in the league, resulted in not many power play opportunities. So I think if we're going to see the Leafs take advantage of their skill next year, they need to draw a lot more power plays. So that's something that we'll need to look into as the season goes on, because if they're bottom in the league and penalties drawn again next year, it's not going to be a good thing. We're going to be talking about it again on the radio.
With Ian Tulloch, who covers the Leafs for The Athletic, this is Sportsnet Today, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Different direction here, Ian. We talk about contention windows because we live in a cap world in the National Hockey League. Understanding the reality of the situation, especially with these second contracts now and RFAs, star RFAs, really wanting to get paid. Is there a way for a draft and develop team to keep its core together, to sustain success beyond a 3-year, 4-year, 5-year window when you don't have top 5 first round draft picks anymore? Like, it just feels like all we do, whether it's Nylander or now Marner or who the hell's going to play defense for this team in 2020, it feels like all we do is worry about the business of the game. Is there a way to sustain success?
It's definitely more difficult now than it used to be, especially if we go back before the salary cap came into effect. You could just pay as much as you wanted for players, and you look at teams like Detroit, who loaded up on Hall of Famers like Luke Robitaille, Brett Hull, Dominic Hasek. You could pay for a Stanley Cup if you really wanted to. These days, there's a salary cap, and if you're allocating a ton of your resources to your star players, it's going to be a lot tougher for you to fill out your roster. I think that the teams who draft the best, develop their talent, and are best at finding those smart players on the bottom end of the rosters on cheaper contracts, those are going to be the teams that are able to sustain success. If you don't draft well, if you trade away all of your draft picks and all of your young assets, and you don't do a good job of filling in the periphery and free agency when it comes to the players that you find on PTOs or the players that you sign for $1 million or $2 million, then you're going to struggle because you're just not going to have the depth to contend. But when we're talking about contending windows, it's funny because we tend to say, oh, you have a 2 or 3 year contending window. You have a 3 or 4 year contending window. But then I think of a team like Washington, for example. We look at their team that won the Stanley Cup. That was nowhere near the best version of Washington that we've seen. In fact, if you go back over the last 10 years, it might be one of their worst teams that they iced, but they continually put out a very strong team that had a good chance of finishing high in the standings and making a bit of a run in the playoffs. They tended to run into Pittsburgh every year in the playoffs and get eliminated in the second round. But if you keep putting out a good team that has, let's say, a 5% chance of winning the Stanley Cup, it might happen for you one year. I mean, just look at the Raptors this past season. No one would have said before the season that they were the favorite to win the championship. But if you give yourself a good chance, a good roster, and you can stay healthy heading into the playoffs, I think there's an argument to be made that your contending window can be as long as you're competitive. So in the modern day in the NHL, where things are so crazy and the underdogs in the playoffs are winning most rounds. I mean, we had the top seed in both the East and the West this year go out in the first round. So you don't even need to be an elite team to have a legitimate chance at the Stanley Cup. So if we're talking about a contending window, as long as you can remain competitive and a strong team for a 5 to 10 year stretch, I'd argue that you can sustain success for a long period of time. It's just going to be difficult to win that Stanley Cup because hockey is such a wide open sport. There are a lot of bounces, and all it takes is an injury here or a bad bounce there, and you're out in the second round. But I do think contending windows are longer than we tend to assume because sometimes crazy stuff just happens. That's the sport that we watch, the sport we love, and this is why we love hockey, because sometimes underdogs win, sometimes crazy things happen. And that's what you got to hope for if you're a Leafs fan. Maybe they get past Boston next year and they go on a bit of a run.
Yeah, and, you know, Ian, you brought up Tampa Bay. Great example. Stamkos was a first overall pick. Hedman, a second overall pick. Washington get Backstrom, Ovechkin, you know, Pittsburgh, Malkin, Crosby. And then you got to find other ways to do it because Netsoff, you know, in Washington's case came years later. And, you know, Scott's point about helping teams develop, the owners will argue that it's already in place. It's called the entry-level salary cap. So, you know, the Maple Leafs have enjoyed 3 years of Nylander, Marner, and Matthews developing at a relatively reasonable salary. I know Mike Zigomanis was on last week with me, and you start talking about, well, maybe if you keep a player that you're developing, it doesn't count the same against the cap. All I know is that's pie in the sky. The cap is the cap is the cap. It ain't going to change at all. It's a hard cap. There'll never be a soft cap. They'll negotiate things like escrow and other things in the next CBA. So this is the real world challenge, and the real world challenge is different now for restricted free agents, and that's one little piece that, say, the Penguins and Capitals didn't have to deal with a couple of years ago like teams like the Leafs have to deal with in 2019.
Yeah, so basically, if we're looking at star players who are trying to advocate for getting paid what they actually deserve, for the longest time, if you looked at the most underpaid players in the league, it was players on their contract immediately after their entry level, because entry level contracts are obviously going to be an underpayment. They're capped out at about $900,000. For superstars who were drafted first overall, the most money you can get is about $3.5 million on your entry level deal. And for a superstar like Matthews or McDavid, that's obviously an underpayment. Now we're starting to see superstars on their second contracts get paid a lot closer to what they deserve. You see Austin Matthews at $11.34 million. You're seeing what Mitch Marner's advocating for right now. You're seeing what Jack Eichel got on his contract, Leon Draisaitl. We're seeing a lot more money being allocated to star players. So that's no longer the market inefficiency that you can take advantage of, because star players are getting paid what they deserve to be paid. So now you need to find players who are getting paid less than they deserve. And I think the next window to do that is in the second tier, is in that second, third line area. You look at a Kasper Kapanen, Andreas Janssen. I mean, let's look at St. Louis winning the championship. Robert Thomas on an entry-level deal was excellent. Sam Girard in Colorado just signed a very cheap contract. I think that's going to be great for them. I think the Leafs are going to be looking to do something similar with Travis Dermott. If you can get him signed to a team-friendly contract, that's what's going to help you win the Stanley Cup. Because if we go to every team's cap-friendly page and we see a team with a lot of players who are overpaid, that team's probably not going to finish too high in the standings. And then conversely, if we go to a cap-friendly page and we see a team with, ooh, that's a good contract. Ooh, that's a great contract. Ooh, what an underpayment there. You're looking at Tampa Bay's cap-friendly page, and they finish first in the league. So it really comes down to which team can spend their money the wisest. And if you can't do that at the top end of the spectrum with the superstars, you're going to have to do it with your second-tier players. That's going to be the new way to kind of take advantage of the salary cap. And the teams that do that best, I think, are going to be the teams that you see finishing in the higher end of the standings and the teams that you see lasting until May or June in the NHL playoffs.
Ian, one of my favorite pieces you've written was right after the trade when the Leafs acquired Tyson Barrie. You did a really nice breakdown of what Leafs fans can expect from him. You know, it's not exactly Jake Gardner. He's quite a bit like Jake Gardner, but I wonder if you could just give a quick overview for our listeners of what you expect out of Tyson Barrie this season.
So he's an interesting player in that he reminds me a lot of Morgan Rielly. He's an exceptional offensive player that when you watch him play, he skates up and down the ice, always involved with the play. If you looked at defensemen who had the most touches in the offensive zone, the most time with the puck on their stick, it was Tyson Barrie, Morgan Rielly, Erik Karlsson, Roman Josi, those players who always have the puck on their stick. Tyson Barrie is right up there with the elite offensive defenseman in the league. So when you see him jumping up into the rush with Mitch Marner and John Tavares or Austin Matthews and William Nylander, I think he's going to be able to generate a ton of offense at 5-on-5. And I'll even be fascinated to see if they use him on the first unit power play, because unlike Morgan Rielly, he actually has a legitimate threat of a slap shot from the point. I think that could really help with the spacing on the power play, because we saw Boston essentially ignore Morgan Rielly on the power play because he doesn't have a slap shot from the point. He has a little wrister that he's able to get through traffic. But if you abandon that, it forces Rielly into a low percentage shot on the power play. I think with Tyson Barrie there, all of a sudden, it's a lot more difficult to defend. So offensively, I think he's going to make a huge impact on the team. I think it probably makes the most sense to play him with Jake Muzzin, because Muzzin's the more reliable, strong defensive player, whereas Barrie's a bit more dynamic with the puck. Maybe you want Rielly on one pairing, Barrie on the other pairing. That way you have at least one dominant puck mover on each line. The hard part with Barrie is that he does struggle a bit defensively. And I think because he plays such a high-tempo game and he's always jumping up into the play, it results in a forward often covering for him. And as we all know, forwards aren't as good at skating backwards and controlling their gaps in transition as defensemen are. So I think when Barrie's on the ice, the Leafs are going to be one of the best scoring teams in the NHL. But I think they're also going to give up a bunch. So you might get frustrated with Barrie when he jumps up into the play and it results in a 3-on-2 the other way. But throughout the course of his career, the pros have outweighed the cons. And I think much like Morgan Riley, that's what we're going to see. A ton of offense, a lot of fun hockey, a lot given up on the defensive end. But at the end of the day, when you add everything up, the pros should outweigh the cons. And I'm looking really forward to see what he can do with this offensive team, because he's a fantastic puck mover and one of the better offensive defensemen in the NHL.